This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil. After the Taliban claimed victory on Monday over opposition forces in the Panjshir Valley, northeast of Kabul, they assured the people there, who are ethnically distinct from the Taliban, that and fought against the Islamists during their rule from 1996 to 2001, that there would be no discriminatory act against them. Pictures on social media showed Taliban members standing in front of the gate of the Panjshir Provincial Governor's compound after fighting over the weekend with the National Resistance Front of Afghanistan that was led by the Panjshiri leader Ahmad Massoud. Massoud, who leads a force drawn from remnants of regular Afghan army and special forces units, as well as local militia fighters, said in a Twitter message he was safe, but he gave no details. U.S. President Joe Biden returned to Washington on Monday night and from a holiday weekend in the U.S. state of Delaware, telling a reporter who asked him on his arrival at the White House if he will recognize the Taliban, that's a long way off. The reporter had also asked Biden what will happen to Afghans stuck in third countries. That's in reference to evacuees who fled the country as the Taliban took power. But Biden appeared not to hear that question. Biden had approached the gaggle of reporters on the White House lawn and appeared to want to make a statement saying that we've got a big day tomorrow, but he broke off as members of the media pool began shouting questions about Afghanistan. Biden is planning to travel to New York and New Jersey on Tuesday, parts of which saw extreme flooding from remnants of Hurricane Ida last week. This is VOA News. The resurgence of COVID-19 this summer and the national debate over vaccine requirements have created a fraught situation for the United States first responders who are now dying in larger numbers but pushing back against mandates. It is a stark contrast from the beginning of the vaccine rollout when the first responders were prioritized for shots. The mandates affect tens of thousands of police officers, firefighters, and others on the front lines across the country, many of whom are spurning the vaccine. That is happening despite mandates' consequences that range from weekly testing to suspension to termination. Even though the virus is now the leading cause of U.S. law enforcement line-of-duty deaths, according to the Officer Down Memorial page, 132 members of law enforcement agencies are known to have died of COVID-19 in 2021. In Florida alone, last month, six people affiliated with law enforcement died over a 10-day period. Chile on Wednesday began administering booster shots to those already inoculated with the Sinovac COVID-19 vaccine in a bid to lock in early success following one of the world's fastest mass vaccination drives. Lines of elderly citizens eager to participate in the campaign began forming at vaccination centers in neighborhoods across the capital, Santiago, on a cool midwinter morning in the southern hemisphere. Chile's blistering campaign has seen upwards of 67% of its population fully vaccinated, predominantly with the Sinovac CoronaVac, but authorities last week said that studies had shown a booster was necessary to shore up immunity. The South American nation on Wednesday began offering a dose of Oxford's AstraZeneca vaccine to citizens age 86 and older who received their initial shots. Chile joins the United States, Germany, France, and Israel in giving the booster shots, despite a plea by the World Health Organization to hold off until more people around the world get their first shot of the vaccine. Two critical jobless benefit programs have expired, leaving only a handful of economic options for millions of Americans who are still financially impacted by the year-and-a-half-old coronavirus pandemic. One program provided jobless aid to self-employed and gig workers, and another provided benefits to those who have been unemployed more than 6 months. Further, the Biden administration's $300 weekly supplemental unemployment benefit also ran out on Monday. There's more at voanews.com. Fire remotes, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Guinea's military leader makes pronouncements to the liking of some Guineans.
They have said it clearly that they will call all Guineans for dialogue. We need to rewrite our constitution. We need to sit together and define the future of our country.
Some Guinean civil societies say they are hesitant joining a future unity government. The regional group ECOWAS will meet this Thursday in an extraordinary summit on Guinea. Cameroon separatists allow schools to reopen after 3 to 5 years. And Somalia's prime minister suspends his intelligence chief.
Robles said he was acting because Yassin had failed to deliver a report on the killing of one of the agency spies, Ikran Talil Farah, who disappeared in June and was declared dead by NISA.
And the impact of the Green Revolution on small-scale farmers in Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Guinea's military leader, Lieutenant Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, has been making a number of declarations since overthrowing the government of President Alpha Condé on Sunday. He promised on Monday that the military would establish a unity government to work on a transition. Doumbouya also assured economic and financial partners that the military will respect all obligations. Faye Milimono, the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party, says some Guineans are liking what they are hearing so far from the military junta, especially the promise that they did not seize power to engage in a witch hunt. Milimono says while most Guineans want accountability for what happened in the previous administration, they don't want any harm to former President Condé or members of his cabinet.
They have stated clearly that they will call all Guineans for dialogue. We need to rewrite our constitution. We need to sit together and define the future of our country. And they asked all the government members to come this morning, and all of them went. And also, they said they didn't take over to stay, but the one this time, the democracy we're talking about, the rule of law we're talking about, they want the foundation to be made. It's not a matter of 1 day or 2 days, but they want the foundation to be made with the contribution of all Guineans. And what is important in what they have said is there won't be any retaliation against anybody. And as ourselves, we are asking them, we want Alpha Condé to be safe, to be protected. We don't want any violence against him.
Did they arrest anyone?
No, they didn't arrest anyone. They told them no one of them should go out of the country, because probably when Guinean people get together to define the future, we want to know what happened during the last 10 years, who did what. And we know that our countries are ruled by corruptions and so on and so on. So they told them clearly that they have to stay in place. They didn't arrest anybody, only those who didn't abide by, you know, what they told them.
Did the military junta free any prisoners?
Some of them, they had said yesterday that they're going to free them. I think some of them are already free. And I think all of them in the end are going to be free.
The Economic Community of West African States has called for an extraordinary summit. I think it's on Thursday this week. What is the view there about the summit?
Look, for us, they have condemned the coup by principle. Nobody wanted what happened to happen. Nobody. As long as we are in the spirit of building a democracy, a rule of law country, nobody will accept what happened. But that being said, we know that the change of the constitution by the former president was blessed by ECOWAS leaders. Personally, with some other opposition leaders, we went all the way to Abuja to the Bukavu's Court of Justice just to prevent the former president from changing our constitution to seek another term. Nobody didn't listen to us. We know that some of them have done what they could to prevent the president from changing the constitution. But in the end, what we have concluded is that he got the blessing from the majority of ECOWA leaders to change the constitution and seek a third term.
Faya Milimuno is the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. In Guinea, a leading member of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, the FNDC, a political pressure group, says leaders of the group are not ready to be part of a future unity government, as suggested by a coup leader, Lieutenant Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya. Fiano Balde, who is also president of the board of the Research Institute on Democracy and Rule of Law, says there needs to be a thorough and independent investigation into allegations of corruption and violation of human rights during former President Alpha Conde's rule. His remarks come after the military junta met with former ministers who served in former President Alpha Conde's government. Balde spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty.
You know, right now, we are not really talking about the unity government yet, because we have to have a dialogue, we have to have a consultation, know exactly where we are heading, what are their objectives, in order to decide whether we are going to join any national government unity or not at this time. The main concern is the freedom of the political detainees. And once they are released, we have to sit together, discuss, and find out how we are going to proceed. Because we have learned so many mistakes from the former junta back in 2009 and 2010. We have to avoid making the same mistakes.
Now, but Tiano, the coup leader says there will be no witch hunt of former ministers, but justice will take its course. How are people reacting to this? And are you taking his word or promise for it? Because he said that the mistakes of the past will not be repeated.
We have heard so many speeches, you know, from former leaders. It's not really the most important issue when we are talking about the transition. We would like to see results. If any of us, we are fighting for the consolidation of democracy and rule of law in Guinea. So it means we don't want arbitrary arrest, we don't want injustice and so on. But we have to make sure that the rule of law is really reality in Guinea.
I understand, but what rule of law are they going to follow since the constitution has been suspended?
Yes, you know, the constitution has been suspended, yes. But other than the constitution, we have all of the other legislation in place. We have the criminal code, we have the procedural code, we have the civil code, and so on and so on. All of the legislation, except the constitution, is in place. And don't forget, Guinea has signed and ratified all of the, most of the UN treaties, the UN Covenant on Political and Civil Rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the West African Union, you know, treaties and so on. So even if we don't have a constitution right now, still, we have a very strong and good legislation which will allow us to have a free and fair trial for anyone who might be involved in any given situation in conflict with the law.
That was Tiano Balde, president of the board of the Research Institute on Democracy and the Rule of Law in Guinea. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, plans to hold an extraordinary virtual summit on Guinea this Thursday, September 9, in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. It follows the overthrow of Guinean President Alpha Condé's government by a section of the military led by Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya. Both ECOWAS and the African Union have zero tolerance policies against military coups and have condemned the coup in Guinea. Paul Ijimi is an international affairs analyst and a former ECOWAS official. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that both the AU and ECOWAS must have the political will to ensure African governments are accountable and meet the aspirations of their people as part of the effort to prevent future military overthrows of constitutionally elected civilian administrations.
So I think it's not about meeting, but the political will to do the needful. And what is the needful? To make leaders accountable to the people and not allow leaders to begin to tinker with the constitution to cling on to power. That is what President Condé has done. And look at where it has landed everybody. In Mali, it was the same thing. President Keita could not do anything about the insecurity in Mali. The ECOWAS and AU and others, those who are condemning the coup today now, stood by and watched while Condé amended the constitution and bulldozed his way. I think now they have to walk the talk. The summit, if they now decide to make sure that, to show an example.
ECOWAS and the African Union have both zero tolerance for the forceful overthrow of a legitimately elected government. Now you have the situation in Guinea where it appears there's a groundswell of support for the coup with no bloodshed reported. What is the way forward for these two groups?
The way forward is to implement, to execute if you have them in your protocol. Yes, I know what you're talking about. ECOWAS has that. The protocol on, democracy and good governance. But beyond the statement, you have to act, you have to give teeth to the statement. And that is what is happening. ECOWAS has not done that in the past 10 years or so. Cote d'Ivoire and the Gambia were put on the line. You know, when they were crossing the line, when ECOWAS refused to go and observe the election that President Jammeh in 2011, ECOWAS, AU, and the others, African leaders, they have to rise up, they have to wake up to the fact that governance and leadership is about service to the people, about the well-being of their people, about the protection of the rights of their people. Beyond that, all talk about zero tolerance mean nothing.
What is your take on the latest development so far following the meeting of the military junta in Guinea the former ministers telling them not to leave the country, hand over their passport, and announcing that there will be a government of national unity to be announced soon? Are they taking the right steps, in your view?
Well, that is the trade that they normally follow. They will now announce a transition government like they have done in Mali. That is what they call deja vu. You know, they can rise. The people have to rise and take up their own destiny in their own hands. It is not for anybody, not for external forces, but let the people of Africa decide to take their own destiny in their own hands and say no to dictatorship and say no to leaders that are not obeying, are not governing by the principles of democracy.
Paul Ijimi is an international affairs analyst and a former ECOWAS official. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 7th. Somalia's Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble is facing off with President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed over the suspension of the country's spy chief. Roble suspended the director of Somalia's National Intelligence Service Agency, also known as NISA, Fahad Yassin, on Monday for failing to deliver a report on the murder of one of the agency's spies. As Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu, President Abdullahi Mohamed says the suspension is unconstitutional.
Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble announced Monday morning that he is suspending Fahad Yassin, the director of Somalia's National Intelligence and Security Agency. Robles said he was acting because Yassin had failed to deliver a report on the killing of one of the agency's spies, Ikran Talil Farah, who disappeared in June and was declared dead by NISA. A few hours later Monday, President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo rejected the Prime Minister's action, saying he has no constitutional mandate to suspend the spy chief and urge Yassin to continue in his role. Security analyst Samira Ahmed of Mogadishu-based Hiral Institute says it will be helpful for an outside party to intervene. She says there is a need for non-partisan mediators to end the escalating political difference between the two highest offices in the country. If that does not happen, she says there is a threat of division as the security forces will be obliged to choose between the conflicting orders. She says this will result in security threats to the country and the ongoing elections. The mother of slain officer, Ali Mahmoud, welcomed the Prime Minister's move to fire the spy chief and appealed to the President to support it. She urged the President not to obstruct justice for her alleged murdered daughter by blocking the Prime Minister's decision. She asked the head of state to put himself in her shoes as a parent seeking justice for her child. It's nothing new for Somali President and Prime Minister to be at odds over the powers of their respective offices. Musa Ahmed, a law expert at Somali National University, believes there is need for a clear separation of powers in the Somali draft constitution. He says the absence of the constitutional court has complicated the recurrent political difference between Somali President and his Prime Minister. He says the appointing powers of the two leaders in the constitution is also not clear. Therefore, he says there is a need for a new chapter in the draft constitution to make clear the powers of the two, especially during government transitional periods. The leaders of the opposition have welcomed the move by the Prime Minister to suspend the Director of Intelligence, saying it was long overdue. The director himself has not responded to the Prime Minister. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
The school year in Cameroon began yesterday, Monday, with hundreds of schools in the troubled western region of the country reopening their doors for the first time in 3 to 5 years. Anglophone separatists previously used threats to keep the schools closed, but some rebels for the first time are saying that schools should be spared from the conflict. Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's government said Monday that several hundred schools reopened in its restive English-speaking northwest and southwest regions. Most schools in the regions have been shut down for 3 to 5 years since the start of a separatist conflict to carve out an English-speaking state from Cameroon and its French-speaking majority. Ngida Lawrence-Che is the most senior government official in Kambé, a western district. He says at least half a dozen schools that were sealed by separatists in the 17 villages that make up Nkambe have reopened.
The turnout in these schools is so encouraging. Every single village of the subdivision can boast of functioning schools. This time around, our population are more than ever before determined that these schools must go operational.
The government reports that separatists attacked or set fire to more than 200 schools between 2017 and 2019, and nearly all schools in the northwest and southwest regions were shut down. Capo Daniel is Defense Chief of Staff for the Amazonian Defense Forces, or the ADF, said to be the largest separatist group in Cameroon. He says ADF has also, for the first time in 5 years, given instructions for schools to reopen.
The future independent state of Ambazonia will not be governed by uneducated people. That is why it is very important for us to institute this alternative educational system, even in the middle of our struggle for separation from Cameroon.
Capo, however, warned government troops not to set foot on any school campus in the restive regions. He said fighters have been instructed to make sure the national anthem of Cameroon is not sung in English-speaking schools. Capo said any school that fails to respect ADF orders will be closed and their teachers and students will be punished. Asheri Kilo is the Secretary of State to Cameroon's Minister of Education. She says children in areas where fighters still prohibit education should be admitted in schools in safer areas.
You know that we are suffering the problem of insecurity, but while certain places get worse, other places are getting better. And the minister has devised a way of using those teachers who were posted in places that are not exactly safe to go to places that are safe and make up the manpower so as to teach these children.
There was no immediate word Monday on how many students in the Northwest and Southwest regions had returned to school. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The so-called Green Revolution in Africa has increased industrial farming, harmed the economic well-being and environmental conditions of small-scale farmers and rural residents in Africa over the past 15 years, according to a group of international organizations. Last week, the group called on Western governments and private foundations to stop funding industrial agriculture in Africa. Million Bile is general coordinator of the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa. He spoke with Ricky Stryak about how the efforts by some groups have failed to meet their promises and, in fact, made life harder for some in Africa.
So it started by two philanthropists, the Gates Foundation, I believe Melinda Gates Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation, and later on other governments chipped in. Basically, they have identified 13 countries, West Africa, Southern Africa, Eastern Africa, basically. And in these identified countries, what they have done is they started to use local experts to promote what I've told you, you know, the usage of high yielding variety and also fertilizers and pesticides, and also to reorient the production into market. And much more insidiously and bigger and long-lasting impact is on influencing laws and regulations in those countries on seeds, on artificial fertilizers, on pesticides. They have destroyed soils and polluted water, groundwaters, and also because of the kind of agriculture that they are following, African seeds, which are tested for generations, the usage has decreased quite significantly. And we felt that they shouldn't continue because the path that they are leading Africa into is much more dangerous and it's not sustainable.
Can you give me some examples of what you've seen in Ghana as terms of sustainable examples that you might have seen from small scale farmers that you think need more attention, need more resources?
Yeah, I think the examples in Ghana, they have promoted maize, promise that farmers would increase the productivity of their maize, and they would be able to pay the money that they borrowed to pay to purchase fertilizers and pesticides. But they couldn't do that, and the government has to subsidize the farmers.
Is government policy the best and most efficient way to address these?
Policy, you know, government policy is important because it shows the path, the direction that the country wants to go. That's why policy is important. But, you know, so many countries have very beautiful and good policies. They are not putting money into their policies. You know, the actions and the money goes somewhere else. Agricultural investment in Africa is very low. But we have a solution now. As a network, we are not only opposing, but we have gathered data after data, stories after stories to tell us that agroecology, which is basically a form of agriculture, which is nature-based, which increases productivity, produces nutritious food, healthy food, which is very good for the environment, you know, for the biosphere, because we are living in an environment where the climate is changing and the biodiversity eroding for a range of environmental benefits, and producing culturally appropriate and healthy food.
That was Melian Bile, General Coordinator of the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Sweden. And that's it for this Tuesday, September 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.